cover of the affordability initiative for CNU, and that means that together with Neil Payton, and we are trying to keep up the pressure on New Urbanism to make sure they're paying attention to some of the issues having to do with maintaining affordability in their projects. The panel that we have here is really very much focused on the how-tos of, okay, we've established that there's a problem with affordability. How might we work affordability into new urbanist projects? And we have three different perspectives that we're going to hear from our panelists today. I'm going to start out just very briefly showing you the results of a survey I did of new urbanist projects. And I really wanted to, I'm a faculty in urban planning at Arizona State University. And while I was at University of Illinois, I undertook this research. And I really wanted to just get to the bottom of just how unaffordable has new urbanism gotten. Can we really say that new urbanist projects tend to not be affordable? And because I actually had people in new urbanism arguing vehemently with me that that was not the case, and that actually there's a lot of affordability, and that the way new urbanism gets new affordability is through its design, by having, I think Henry Cisneros referred to it as natural affordability. And that is that if you design smaller units and, you know, do certain efficiencies in project development, you will get to better affordability. I don't think any of us doubt that that is one important way to go. The issue is how much further does one need to go to really get to achieving a diverse community. So let me just run through these slides really quickly. I know I'm only the moderator, so I'm kind of slipping this in here, but I did want to have the chance to show you some of this data I collected. And is that coming out very well? I started with 320 new urbanist projects that I knew of. Rob Studeville was very helpful in getting me that initial list of projects to work with all over the country. I wanted to separate out, and this is just, there's all kinds of maps. I love mapping, where they're located, where they tend to be clustered. But the survey that I did, I had some money for grad students. What I wanted to do was just focus on the market rate new urbanist projects, not the Hope 6 projects, not the projects that have gotten publics, been lucky enough to get some public subsidy to ensure affordability. Those are the good guys, in my opinion. Those are the model projects. Those are the ones that do have affordability worked in. What we want to get to, and what I think our panel is directed at, is trying to get to the greenfield, mostly greenfield, but also some infill project development that hasn't taken advantage of those public subsidies and other mechanisms for getting affordability built in. Just how bad is it with those market rate projects? Not bad if you're the developer and you're selling property, certainly, but and so one of the first things I did was compare the census tracts that had the new urbanist projects that I used. Oh, and by the way, I narrowed it down, taking out those public subsidy projects, I narrowed it down to 234 projects. And then I did a survey of those by calling up, emailing, you know, really pestering developers to give me some numbers on what their units were selling for in their developments. And we had a response rate of something like 65% where we were able to get data. What we asked for is, how much does it cost to buy into this project? We also got data on rentals, but let me just focus on buying ownership. If you give me the price for your very smallest unit, condo, townhouse, single-family home, if that's the issue, I want to know, can a school elementary school teacher get into this new urbanist project? So that's how we started. And the results were basically that, this is some data comparing the tracks that the new urbanist project is in compared to the tracks for the whole urban area. That's getting a little off topic. So we had data for 152 out of 234 projects, response rate 65%. Lowest, we compared then the lowest priced unit in those projects to the salary of a middle income person. Those numbers are from HUD, and the salaries of a teacher working in that location, in that county, and the salary of a cook. You know, and that was obtained from salary.com. It's a really great website. Here's basically what we found. 15% of the units were affordable to the area median income. 10% of, not the units, 15% of the projects had a unit that would be affordable to that level. 10% had of the projects were affordable to teachers, and 0.07 could accommodate a cook. So this is just one way to try to get at some empirical basis for what some of us in New Urbanism have been clamoring about, and that is, hey, New Urbanism is not very diverse and affordable, and this is a problem. And so I'm very happy to report that I think a lot of people in CNU are committed to trying to do something about that. Hence the panel that we put together today. And I've got it graphed every which way and all kinds of other fun charts, but I want to get to our panelists. I've taken up too much time already. Okay, so let me introduce our panelists. And are we going to go in this order?
Sure.
Why don't we? Let me first introduce Andy Northstein, who is a planner with Gladding Jackson Kircher Anglin. Ooh, that's a mouthful. In Orlando, Florida. And he is, I became alerted to his work through an excellent book that he wrote, which was called New Directions in Affordable Housing. And it's a fantastic compendium of all kinds of mechanisms that can be used to build in affordability. And he is the firm's affordable housing expert, and he is going to talk to us from the perspective. Our three perspectives here are private developer pulling in affordability to a market rate project, inclusionary zoning, and finally community land trusts as three different strategies. So let me just start. Well, I guess I'll just go ahead and introduce everybody right now while I'm standing up here. Liz Mueller is a faculty in the Department of Community and Regional Planning in the School of Architecture at UT Austin, and she has a lot of experience with inclusionary zoning. She teaches that and has a background, has a doctorate from Berkeley in city planning. And then we have Kelly Weiss, and I lost the notes that she just gave me. Here they are. Okay, she was the affordable housing director in charge of the affordable housing programs for the city of Austin for many years, and now she has just recently come to be in a brand new organization called People Trust, and she's the executive director of People Trust, and it is the first and only community land trust nonprofit organization in the state of Texas. So, way to go, Texas. All right, Andy, take it away.
Thank you. Not used to the Mac world here.
Uh-oh. Oh, it's already here. What did we do? There we go. And then you got that thing.
Thank you. So thank you all for spending what I know is a beautiful Saturday afternoon sitting in a conference room with no windows talking about a pretty complicated and esoteric topic. I really appreciate you all hanging out here. As Emily already plugged for me, I have a book out called New Directions in Affordable Housing, and I know a lot of people are plugging their books at this conference, but the difference with mine is that it is 100% free. If you're sort of new to the topic of affordable housing, if you are looking for sort of a primer guide, a sort of 101, what is this issue, what are the terms, what are the strategies, and kind of a very sort of broad, general sort of overview, this might be something that would interest you. It's available on our website, which is up there, or you can also come talk to me afterwards, and I'll give you my contact information and make sure you get a copy. There's three questions that I was going to try to answer in this presentation. Isn't the market already solving this problem? What can private developers do, and why should they bother to do anything? So let's first of all look at the first question. We hear on the news all the time, every day, every night, that there are further worse numbers. So isn't the market already taking care of this problem? I think the short answer is no, at least not yet. This is a really interesting chart here that shows housing values all the way back through 1890, adjusted for inflation. And you can see there's a pretty big sort of bust period here during the World Wars and the Great Depression. But really, once we hit 1945 through about 1995, the values stayed pretty much within a sort of stable range. There were definitely sort of economic peaks and economic boom and bust periods, but for the most part, we stayed in the same range. Then look what happened after 1995. I wanted to pull an Al Gore here and do the little cherry picker cart going up in the air, but they wouldn't let me do that. So clearly, we saw something in the last 6, 7 years, 10 years that had never before happened in this nation's history. So this wasn't just a normal boom period. Concurrent with that, we also saw incomes decrease for the first time over a five-year period since World War II. So you had these two almost completely unprecedented sort of macroeconomic trends happening at the same time. Just to use an example from where I'm from, Orlando, from 01 to 06, we jumped in value, our median housing prices, from about 118 to 250,000, so about 111% increase. For 2007, the entire year, we were down only 1.2%. We're down to around 225, 230,000 or so right now, but there's a big difference between 225,000 and 118,000 over a time period where incomes were either not budging or declining for a good segment of Americans. So the short answer is yes, this is still a huge problem, even though the market is declining. So given that we know that's happening, what can developers do, specifically private for-profit developers, which is the group that I primarily work with? There are two sort of tracks that they can take. The first is subsidized solutions, and the second are the sort of more free market solutions, and we'll talk more about that and whether or not those are really valid. Starting with the subsidized solution, when we're talking about subsidized solutions for private developers, there's really only one sort of thing that we're talking about, and that is the low-income housing tax credit. It's commonly referred to as the only game in town, and that's because for a lot of reasons, and I'll show you some statistics, it really is the only game in town. It started in the mid-80s under President Reagan, and his goal, or the administration's goal at that time, was to give the private sector more of a role in the affordable housing arena. Critics would say that it was actually sort of the federal government advocating responsibility for housing low-income people, but no matter which way you look at it, it's pretty clear that it's been by far the most important and effective program for producing affordable housing in the nation. You can see some of the numbers here, and they're pretty astounding. You see 1.5 million units. An interesting thing from my hometown of Orlando, 80% of all affordable housing that happened in our city over the last two decades was at least partially financed through this program. So you can't understate how critical it's been. I'm going to, in lieu of actually telling you how the program works, I'm just going to show you this chart, and you can take 5 seconds and absorb it. Everybody got it? It's pretty simple, right? So, I'll try to simplify what all these arrows going back and forth actually mean here. And this is a very sort of general cursory overview of what is a very complex program, but hopefully I'll give you an idea of how it works. The first step is that the federal government allocates income tax credits
two states based on their population, and that number was about $1.75 per capita in 2003 and has been indexed to inflation. So they give those to the states on an annual basis. The states, in turn, give those to private developers, and they can be for-profit private developers or they can be nonprofit developers. And they do this based on a competitive selection process, and it has to be competitive because in general, there are 2 to 3 times more applications for credits than there are credits available. So it's definitely a large unmet demand there. Then developers, in turn, for receiving these credits, they commit to at least 20% of their units being affordable to those making under 50% of the area median income, or 40% of the units to those making less than 60%. So I know it's a lot of percentages there, but and they must keep those units affordable for a period of at least 30 years. So then the third step is the developers who have received these credits from the state, they then sell those credits to other entities. Usually you're talking about corporations and banks because of the way the tax code is structured. But then the developers receive capital for that sale. The investors, the people who buy the credits, can then use those as a one-to-one credit on their income tax returns, and they spread that out over a 10-year period. So the developer, the final step, he's got those funds, he uses that revenue, he or she uses that revenue to profitably produce affordable housing. And again, there's nonprofits that engage in this too, but the idea was that this was a way for for-profit private sector developers to be able to profitably do affordable housing. And you can see that the funds can be used for acquisition, rehabbing, or new construction costs. So those of you who work in this program, I know that was a very sort of simplistic overview of what it is, but I hope that kind of, for those of you who don't work with this every day, so it gives you an idea of how it's structured. I just wanted to use an example here that's not showing up. That's weird. Must be a Mac conversion thing here, but there's supposed to be an aerial photograph there of this project. It's not there. This was a low-income housing tax credit finance project, about 50% low-income, 50% market rate. It wasn't a T&D project. It was all multifamily, but this developer did some pretty interesting things with mixed uses. And these pictures don't do it justice, but when I visited this project, it was actually more active than a lot of our other T&D town centers in Central Florida tended to be. There was lots of people walking around and a good mixture of everyday uses that people need. You know, it wasn't doll shops or something. It was, you know, the dry cleaner and daycare and some of the sort of less sexy sort of retail stuff. Here's a picture of their amenities. So you can clearly see that, you know, the way we're producing affordable housing on the private sector is, you know, not something that's ugly or unattractive. Some pros of the program. I mentioned, you know, it's been responsible for the vast majority of affordable housing that we've produced. Without it, I don't think that most for-profit private sector developers would be able to really engage on this issue. And because of the competitive selection process, a lot of developers often also add on social services to these projects. So they offer daycare on site or job training programs, things like that, that really really help low and middle income families. On the con side, it's incredibly complex. Remember the chart that I asked you all to study. There's only a limited number every year, and we're vastly we have a huge unmet demand really in terms of these credits. One of the big problems is that because of that competitive selection process, a lot of states were giving more weight to developers that were willing to do more low-income units. So remember, they're only required to do 20% of the units or 40% of their units as low-income. But in order to win the competitive process, a lot of developers have been doing 80% or 100% of their units as low-income. And of course, we, you know, as planners and designers, we all know the sad history of this country and concentrating low-income people in single places. And another problem is that many of the rules and sort of credit things encourage anti-urbanism or discourage urbanism, depending on how you phrase that. But in Florida, for instance, you get extra points on your application if you have a gated development, if you offer more than two parking spaces per unit, and you don't get any extra points. There's no value to having good transit access or to mixing uses and some of those sorts of things. So that's a big problem with the program. Some free market solutions, and I think this gets back to what Emily was kind of talking about. A lot of new urbanists think that this is maybe the only, you know, route we need to go. You called it natural affordability. But I am going to kind of talk about some of the things that the new urbanists have been doing that, while maybe not contributing to affordability right now, I think in the long run, they'll start to do so. This is a quote from Michael Piatak, who's, for those of you who don't know him, he's probably the leading, he definitely is the leading affordable housing architect in the nation, also one of the great sort of thinkers on this topic. And he says that, you know, the single most important thing to do for housing affordability is basically what new urbanists do, which is mixed use, transit accessible, you know, environments that have a wide variety of different work opportunities. So this is something we're already doing. The other sort of free market solutions, I think, the small units, which I think we can have a little bit of a debate about, and also the transportation affordability. I say do not underestimate the importance of small units. This is, I thought this was pretty funny, the sort of dynamic in the way we're, you know, the style of living, this, I should have bought more crap with the big picture of the McMansion above this guy on his deathbed. You know, this is something that's fading away as our demographics change. We're seeing much more single-person households, more than we've ever seen in our nation's history. We're seeing an aging society. That's Empty Nest, for those of you who remember the bad 80s sitcom. And we're seeing later average marriage and childbearing ages, much, much later. I think in the 70s, the average marriage age was something like 21, and now it's like 27 or 28. So it's a whole bunch of demographic trends that are pointing to small units being very important now and very much undersupplied right now, but especially going forward. A lot of you have probably seen this study from Arthur Nelson that said that by the year 2025, we're going to have an excess of 22 million large lot homes, given both the demographic trends and the current production trends and the way we're building housing today. Those two things converging give us 22 million extra large lots and a deficit of 35 million small lot and small units. So I think while maybe the small units and the new urbanist developments now aren't affordable, I think that can be at least partially attributed to a supply and demand problem. We're already seeing demand boom because of those demographic trends, and we're not supplying them in nearly the volume that we need to. So that needs to be something that we as new urbanists continue keeping in our sort of affordable housing portfolio. And then the other one is the idea that the reduction of transportation costs should actually be thought of as an affordable housing strategy. And this is sort of an emerging idea, this concept of affordable living. If we look at what the median family, the family right in the middle, is paying on housing costs in New York versus Tampa, it's about what everybody in this room would expect. They're paying significantly more for housing in New York City. And this is metro areas, so this isn't just, you know, Upper East Side versus, you know, somewhere in suburban sprawl, Tampa. This is metro regions. Now we look at the transportation costs for that same exact family, and some of you have probably seen these statistics, significantly higher in Tampa. Adding these two together, we see that the median family in Tampa actually has a more unaffordable lifestyle than the median family in New York City. So this idea that we can solve affordable housing or should be addressing affordable housing only by thinking about housing units is completely erroneous. A lot of groups such as the Brookings Institution are pushing this idea that getting away from that 30% threshold for affordable housing and actually thinking about maybe, you know, a 40 or 50% threshold for housing plus transportation combined. So that's something that I think we as new urbanists have a lot to, you know, we have been addressing for quite some time. And finally, I'll conclude with why I think private developers should bother doing anything. This is a quote from Jane Jacobs, and I'd be willing to bet that every single person in this room, every single person at this conference, probably wholeheartedly agrees with this quote, that, you know, we have a social or moral obligation to house the less fortunate, the poor, and the middle class in our society. And, you know, I think that's great that a lot of us feel that way. But if you're a private developer and you're on the phone with your shareholders or, you know, with the Wall Street analysts or whatever, you can't give them a quote like this and tell them that's why you're doing affordable housing. It's not going to work. So, you know, for better or for worse, we have to have other reasons why private developers need to bother. So here are four. There are others, too, that we could talk about, and I'm sure you guys have ideas, too. But a big one is faster absorption rates. There's a lot of studies that show the broader range of housing costs that you're offering in your development, the broader your market that you're targeting. So you're going to sell homes much faster. Second one is pretty applicable to Florida. I don't know how applicable elsewhere, but in Florida you have very high costs on private developers for their external transportation impacts. So any impacts that go onto the road network outside of the project boundaries, developers have to pay for, essentially. But incorporating affordable housing into a mixed-use development, you can actually increase what we call your internal capture, which is the amount of trips that are staying within your boundaries, thus reducing significantly your external impacts. And We have several clients that have been able to use this idea to save significant amounts of money in that way. We know there's a high pent-up demand for diverse communities, and we can debate what diverse really means or how diverse of a living situation people are really willing to put themselves in. But clearly, we're seeing it in the home values and new urbanist communities that people want this. And then finally, the demographics is destiny. Again, we're going to have a shortage of 35 million small lot units in 20 years. So, for developers who are working on that 20 or 30 year horizon, the big master plan community developers, this is something that they need to be paying attention to. And their market in 10 years is going to be completely different than their market today. So I'm going to end on a cartoon that's not very funny. I've had this cartoon in here for a long time, and I barely ever get even the slightest polite chuckle out of it. But so if any of you have a funnier affordable housing cartoon, please send it my way. So I look forward to your questions and the debate with the panel. Thanks.
Good to go. The arrow keys to advance.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Hi, good afternoon. I'm Liz Mueller, and I do teach here at UT and also direct the Center for Sustainable Development at the university. So I'm also trying to square the sustainability and equity circle. I'm going to talk a little bit today about inclusionary housing policies and what I think the key things to know about them are for new urbanism and some of the kind of tensions and challenges in them. So first I'm going to go through what they're about, what the goals of them are, the key questions that you usually have to think about and the mechanics of the program and designing it, what I think it takes to have a successful program, and then if I have time I'll tell you a little bit about Montgomery County, Maryland's program, which has been around longer than any other program and I think illustrates some of these points. So first, what this is about, it's kind of hard to define inclusionary housing or inclusionary zoning policies because they vary greatly. But it's really an umbrella term for strategies that are aimed at including affordable housing in larger projects, usually market rate projects. It's also a strategy for meeting housing needs with local resources, leveraging private production at minimal cost to the public sector. And it's more and more important to try and do that as federal resources decline. And it's also a strategy for greater economic and racial integration. In city planning, we don't have a very good history of enabling communities to be very diverse in income or race, and this is in part a response to that. The Montgomery County program certainly was in great part a response to that. But it's important to know that there's not a sort of one-size-fits-all inclusionary zoning or inclusionary housing program. The details of these policies are what make them successful or unsuccessful, both for communities and for developers. And the graphic here that I have is, sorry, didn't come out that sharply, but it's the Mueller Airport redevelopment here in Austin, which I hope some of you got to see, which has a requirement that a quarter of the housing in it be affordable. Both the homeowner and the rental housing. And the homeowner housing has to be affordable to households at 80% of median income and the renter to households at 60% of median income. And it's distributed throughout the site. Okay, so the mechanics. It can be a little bit confusing. I won't go into tremendous detail on this, but I have some examples if people want to ask about it in questions. These are all the things that you have to think about in creating a program, because the basic idea is you're trying to seed some affordability into the growth that you're getting through the market. So you have to decide what set-aside you're going to set. What percentage of units do you want to be affordable within the project? The range is usually between 10 and 25% in programs, and sometimes that varies based on the depth of income targeting you achieve. So if you make the units more affordable, you may be required to have a smaller share. You also have to decide on a project trigger as a community. What size developments are you going to subject to the program? Is it just larger ones? In most places, I think they begin with larger ones saying, you know, 50 units or greater will have to include some share of affordable units. In Montgomery County, as they're building out, they're now lowering that threshold because they're not getting any more units into their program. Then there are income targets. You have to determine what income level you'll serve with the units. And in some cases, cities also identify other programs that could partner with the projects in order to achieve greater depth of affordability. And I can tell you more about that later if you're interested. You also have to consider whether or not you care about whether the units are actually in the development or if you allow the developer to produce them elsewhere, perhaps where land is cheaper. And this goes back to these goals. You know, if you're mostly motivated by wanting to produce more affordable units, you might be willing to say, let's produce them off-site somewhere else where we can produce more at a lower cost. But if you're really concerned about integrating them into different parts of your community, you might say, no, we need to make sure that they are included in the development. So, again, that's going to be specific to the community. There's the issue of whether or not you require units or you allow people to opt to pay into a fund for the production of affordable housing instead of units. Studies show that typically doesn't result in production of very many units. It's hard to set that price right, but that's another decision that communities have to make, and sometimes they make that for very particular reasons. There are high-rise developments or other things where it's very hard to get them included. Compatibility. Do you care about, do you want them to blend in? And often that, you know, communities do. So then you set some standards so that from the exterior they're not going to appear different. It's not going to be possible to kind of identify them as the affordable ones. And then finally there's the term of affordability. You have to decide how long will you require that they remain affordable. And increasingly that time is extending. Because many of the first communities to do this set them fairly short. Like Montgomery County, I think, began with a five-year term. And they were doing this during a period of tremendous production, but then they began losing huge numbers. So now they've really lengthened that. But unfortunately, production has also slowed down quite a bit. So cities are trying to figure out how they can lengthen that, sometimes through land trust options and other things as strategies for doing that. And Kelly will give us more background on that. But overall, you have to put together a package that's going to make sense for your community. You're setting these different parameters in order to get at the goals that you think are important and also to make it a workable balance for the developers. It's often politically, I think it's a lot easier to focus on that maximum number produced than it is on the integration issue, which, you know, NIMBY, it's not so easy to get those units integrated into higher income developments. And also the depth of affordability issue is quite difficult as well. Okay, so the most important thing, though, is will developers participate? And this is my one little attempt at a cartoon. Designated area of outstanding natural profitability. You know, if you don't have a good environment for development, this isn't really going to help much for affordability. You know, this program works in a place where there's a lot of demand for development. It's not going to work in a weak market situation. It's also not going to solve all your affordable housing problems. It's going to be part of the bigger array of things that you're doing, and you'll have to think about how it fits in, where it's going to work best. Often, you know, the big issue that's often the big hot button in this area is whether or not you're going to require developers to participate. And, of course, there's always interest on the part of policymakers in mandating it because studies show you get more units if you mandate it. The reality is there are many more places that have voluntary programs than mandatory programs. And, you know, in either case, you're going to have to figure out how to compensate developers in some way for participating in the program. Some recent research that's come out, I think, add some important detail to this debate because the authors of this study looked in great depth at three different regions around the country and what the jurisdictions within those metropolitan areas did, and they really found that it was more important that you had a local base of support for inclusionary policies. You could have a state rule that said you had to have some sort of a density bonus or, you know, some sort of policy in place, but if you didn't have that local commitment, you probably hadn't put together all those pieces of the mechanics I showed you for it to work. So they actually found in several communities in Boston where they have a state law that does trigger density bonus trade-offs, they weren't producing any units because there wasn't really any local buy-in and they hadn't set up all of the parameters to make it happen. So I think, you know, the local level is incredibly important in this picture. The way that developers are most often compensated for participating is through things like density bonuses, where they're allowed to build greater density than residential zones would typically offer, and often can include additional market rate units than they would have been able to, more units than they would have been able to. There are also things like allowing for smaller units to be produced, which can lower land and construction costs. You know, you can see that many of these things, though, can come into conflict with planning goals, so you have to be really, really careful. Or you may have identified a need for family housing, so you don't want to necessarily say you can have smaller units if that's where your need lies or that's what you're targeting with this program. But in some places, it might work. You can adjust parking requirements and allow fewer spaces. You could allow for design flexibility on setbacks, lot size requirements, and other things, or FAR for developers. You can waive different types of fees. This one is a little bit more charged because that will represent a loss of revenue to the city, so the city will have to budget for that if you do that. Austin's Smart Housing Program does that. It offers fee waivers and also expedited review. You can defer fees. You can say you don't have to pay these fees until you have a certificate of occupancy, so your carrying costs are reduced. And you can offer fast-track permitting to streamline that development review process. Again, here you could have some tensions with local planning because often what causes a process to go long could be the public input piece of it, which you might not want to take out. Okay, so based on my read of a lot of different reports on inclusionary zoning and my own experience participating in a task force last year on incentives for production of affordable housing, here's what I think it takes to succeed. I think that you have to begin with some critical information to frame discussion of this. And the first is about housing needs. If you don't create this program with the bigger picture in mind of where your needs lie, where are the gaps in the market, and just begin negotiating in on those mechanics, you may end up with a program that's not hitting the need. And why are you spending money, public money on that or giving away density for that? So I think that's critical. And you also have to have some agreement on community goals, especially whether or not you think integration of housing opportunities throughout your region matters. Second, you need to have neutral information on development costs. You need to have some kind of market study about development costs by submarket for your area so that when you're having this discussion about the mechanics of the program, there's not this kind of asymmetry of information where the developers know all the real information and the people on the other side really have no basis for judging what's true and what's not. Third, you have to figure out how to link planning and housing. And this is a hard thing because typically these two areas of local government are in their own separate worlds. Housing departments typically get all their money from the federal government. They report to them. They do planning that follows their rules. They're not necessarily integrated into local discussions of planning. And, you know, they're sort of political hot potatoes. There's reasons why other departments don't want to work with them that closely. But with the rise of more and more local programs like this, there's beginning to be more interaction, and there has to be more interaction. So, but there's significant growing pains in trying to make this happen. But we have to figure out how to make those things come together better. Then finally, you really need to engage stakeholders on the mechanics of this process. You know, once you've got your goals in mind, you have some parameters for costs, you have to make sure that this is going to work for the developers or they're not going to participate. It's not going to produce anything. So that has to happen and that has to be ongoing because one thing that you learn from looking at these programs, especially the one, the Montgomery County one, is they have to adjust things over time. Conditions change. The thing that worked initially doesn't work in 10 years. So you have to continue to engage the people involved. You have to do ongoing monitoring, make adjustments. You need to be aware of the costs and benefits to the city if you're waiving fees. You know, you have to have some way to estimate whether or not it's worth it for the city. So it's an iterative process, I think. How am I doing on time?
You have a couple minutes.
Okay. Okay, I'll just tell you a little bit about the Montgomery County program. It's called the Moderately Priced Dwelling Unit Program. Montgomery County is a suburban county outside of Washington, D.C., and this program was established, or I think the ordinance passed in 1973. They didn't actually begin to produce units until 76. But it arose from concerns when that area began growing very rapidly in the 70s and was really changing in character from a largely bedroom community to Washington to becoming more of an employment center for the region. And many of the people working in the region lived in the region. But for many reasons, housing prices were rising very rapidly. They had they didn't have enough infrastructure. They had certain rules about subdivision of land that were kind of making development lag the growth in population. So, and developers were responding by building bigger houses on the lots that they had entitlement to. So they were getting fewer numbers of expensive homes and not the housing they needed for the population they had. So they passed this ordinance, and they had a very extensive discussions about whether or not this constituted a takings from developers, whether it was going to threaten property values to mix people of different incomes together, whether density bonuses would undermine their other planning goals, whether the program should be mandatory or not. I mean, all the kind of things that people are still arguing about in some sense. I think we can learn a lot from what they did. Their goals were to try and enable people who lived and worked in the region to be able to live in the region. They wanted to distribute low and moderate income households throughout the growth areas of the region, and this remains a really strong goal for them. They're really committed to this idea that it should be everywhere. It should go in all developments. So they've been very resistant to allowing people to opt out and pay into a fund or produce off-site. They wanted to build up an inventory of affordable housing by allowing their Housing Opportunities Council, which is their public housing authority, and nonprofits to buy up a lot of the affordable units over time. So as units age out of their program, there's a right of first refusal that the housing authority has or that nonprofits have. So they've been building a stock of affordable housing that way, and they want to provide funds for future affordable housing development. Over time, they've had to make adjustments. They started out with an affordability period that they realized was too short, and they were losing units. So they've extended that. And currently, I think it is 30 years for for sale property and 99 years for rental property. And most of the rental housing produced, I think, also has tax credits or tends to have other subsidies in it. They're serving a lower income population than most other inclusionary zoning type programs are. They serve households between $20,000 and $68,000 annual income, depending on household size, up between 65 and 70% of median family income. They choose their participants by lottery because there's such a tremendous demand for the housing. And let's see. Okay, so it's mostly, did I show you? What did I just show you? I can't see my own slides while I'm talking, sorry. The picture at the bottom is actually a moderately priced development that they produced. Let's see. It's mostly been based on a density bonus. They don't do fee waivers and other things, so they really have been able to say that there's not a big budget hit to them for doing this program, that they are making this density trade-off. But they're finding now, as they've built out the county more, that there are fewer opportunities for developers to actually use that density. They're more likely to use the flexibility and design standards and things like that and voluntarily include moderately priced units to take advantage of those features. So some of the things that they initially thought would matter, you know, are less important now, and they're thinking about how they need to adjust based on that. Okay, I think that's probably about all I can tell you. They did manage to disperse them throughout the region pretty well. As I mentioned before, though, you can see there's been this big drop-off in units being added to the program. So they're now kind of rethinking what can they do now to add more units to this program now that there's no longer a lot of new production going on. Are there other things they can do? But I think it's an interesting example because it's been around long enough that they've had to go through different phases and they've really had to struggle with a lot of the problems that you would have to struggle with in designing the program. And I think part of the lesson is that you have to continue to revisit those issues. You can't just set it up and then think you're done. So that's it.
I'm going to pontificate for a little bit in an attempt to kind of tie these presentations together, and I'm going to jump ahead to a slide that basically states our mission is a new nonprofit, which is permanently affordable home ownership, produces broad social change with lasting impact, changing communities forever. And our motto these days is basically a dollar invested today creates a home forever. Andy and Liz went through kind of the why of developing affordable housing. Andy mentioned a financing mechanism through tax credits and other kind of developer incentives that would make developers want to develop affordable housing. And Liz kind of went through the other spectrum of why developers are sometimes told to develop affordable housing through inclusionary zoning policies through our local governments. My focus, and after coming from a public sector environment working for the city of Austin for about 5 years, I can tell you that I worked way too hard to produce affordable housing to see basically that housing be lost on resale, that affordability be lost on resale. And so when I finally figured out that Austin was no longer the most affordable city to live in the nation, that we really had to do something here in Austin, the community land trust model started making a lot of sense to me. And I was really lucky, and I see people in the audience today that worked with the city housing department to make community land trust a reality here in Texas. For many years, I was told, we can't do that in Texas. That's, you know, anti-American. It goes against the American dream, so to speak, of home ownership. And I don't tell many people this. I came from a background prior to working in the public sector. I was an oil and gas attorney in the private sector, very private sector, and was used to slicing and dicing property rights in so many ways that when I finally understood the model, it made so much sense to me, and it was just like a light went on. With the community land trust. And basically, you get told in law school property rights are this bundle of rights, this kind of bundle of sticks. And it's really just kind of rearranging the sticks in terms of home ownership, which I think is really important because for those of you in the business, it is really hard to produce affordable housing. With that said, and getting a new business started and getting a new nonprofit started, my message to developers is, this is so easy, guys. We can help you out. It's not complicated. It's not esoteric. When you think about it, it's really easy. And here's the model, and we're here to make it work for you. We've also been really lucky in Austin with the Robert Mueller Airport Redevelopment Project and the master developer, Catellus, who got that and who built in certain mechanisms in that redevelopment project to make affordable housing lasting. They stopped short of a community land trust. That we're doing something out there called shared appreciation loans, but we'll eventually work into a community land trust model out there as well. I'm not going to focus on shared appreciation loans today, but they are an important mechanism that creates some sustainability in terms of home ownership. The third thing I would say about shared equity home ownership, it is probably, and home ownership in general, is the most important wealth creation vehicle in America. It provides certain U.S. tax incentives, certain credit benefits. When you start looking at research in terms of educational attainment of children, family stability, home ownership is really important. And when you're talking about meaningful, what I call transformative wealth, for low to moderate income families, you're not going to get any better than home ownership. You know, the transitory nature of rental housing, for instance, wears on a family. You have no control over your rent going up or a landlord, you know, not fixing your apartment, that kind of thing. So home ownership goes a long way in creating family stability. The other thing I would add about shared equity home ownership is it has many applications, greenfield development, but also in terms of mitigating gentrification, infill development, and preserving existing housing stock. There are many kind of ways to approach it through buyer-initiated models where you actually have buyers coming to you and you're providing this service, owner-initiated models. The City of Austin recently implemented a program through their low-to-moderate housing rehab program focused on low-to-moderate income homeowners on the east side of Austin whose housing is really in bad shape. And it's a way for the city to sink a lot of money into fixing up someone's home, but making sure there is a sustainable model to make sure that housing stock remains affordable past that homeowner, which is also really important. There's also been a lot of talk recently about expiring tax credit projects, and there's some, I think, a huge opportunity for the shared equity housing movement, either through land trust or limited equity co-ops, to get in on those expiring tax credit deals. So there are a lot of different applications, I think, that will have meaningful impact in the future as this whole movement of kind of third sector housing starts to scale up, so to speak. And that's been a very big focus on the national front. NeighborWorks hosted a symposium in Portland, Oregon at the end of last year that was focused solely on shared equity housing. And really what came out of that symposium is there is a huge national market demand for this type of affordable housing, home ownership in particular. And until recently, the movement, so to speak, has not gotten a lot of attention. There have been a lot of smaller nonprofits out there doing really good jobs in really difficult communities, but producing a very small handful of permanently affordable home ownership. There was a market study done, and it basically showed that there's a national market right now today if we were to have a product that was widely available that would serve close to 250,000 to 1 million people. And it's a really hard kind of thing to measure as well. The other thing I would note on a national front is there was a recent foreclosure survey done of community land trust homes that have weathered this foreclosure crisis, so to speak. And a lot of that has to do with the one kind of standardized lending product produced by Fannie Mae that has some really significant foreclosure backstopping mechanisms that essentially allow the nonprofit that's involved to step in and stop the foreclosure to either help the homeowner get caught up on their payments or to help the homeowner move to another situation if they truly can't afford the home and substitute another buyer in, but the house remains affordable and in the hands of that nonprofit. And I think that's it. So that was my little spiel on why it's really important. And then I'm going to get into the mechanics of kind of what it is. And this is a spectrum of housing, essentially. On one end, there's kind of this market rate housing that creates maximum wealth building or asset building on one end. And on the other end is ongoing affordability with things like kind of at that far end, affordable subsidized rental. And then that highlighted area in the terms of shared equity housing, they're really two products, shared appreciation loans and subsidy retention. And shared appreciation loans, that's what we're doing out at Mueller. I'm not really going to focus on that today. If you get the community land trust model, shared appreciation loans are a no-brainer, so we'll focus on community land trust. Subsidy retention products, there's really two. Limited equity co-ops not only preserve long-term affordability, it's also a financing mechanism, and it's a very fascinating model. To produce, not only to produce affordable housing, to finance affordable housing and to preserve it. Community land trust is not really a financing mechanism. You have got to have the affordable housing financing in place to make the model work. It's a way to preserve the housing affordability, primarily for home ownership, although it does have some application in rental as well. And this is kind of how it works, how those property rights are sliced and diced. so to speak. We are People Trust. I'm the executive director. Substitute any nonprofit or even a local government jurisdiction in some cases. Generally, they own the land. Now, keep in mind, this is a traditional single-family model. When it comes to condo ownership, it's a little bit different. It's not done through a ground lease. You don't own the land in a condo. It's a deed restriction. But the nonprofit owns the land. There is a ground lease or deed restriction between the nonprofit and the homeowner. And then that homeowner owns the improvements. And that those improvements are essentially financed through a leasehold mortgage. Fannie Mae has a product. Freddie Mac kind of has a product. FHA, depending on the area of the nation you're in, may or may not have a product. FHA does not finance shared equity housing here in Texas, and that's something I'm working on. That's on my task list to change FHA. No easy task. But that's basically it in terms of how the property rights are split. Let's see. The important component is that ground lease or deed restriction. I'm going to run through some of those lease terms that make the model work. The lease term is long-term. Generally, we say 99 years. There are some states that will not allow you to have a deed restriction in perpetuity. There's a rule against perpetuities in law. So we get around that in some creative ways. In Texas, we say it's 99 years with an option to renew. And what that means kind of from my perspective is in building a nonprofit that manages this, you truly have to establish an institution with lasting ability to manage these things long term. There is a letter of acknowledgement. The buyer has to know what they're getting into. I can tell you that when we were getting started about 2 months ago, trying to get insurance for this new nonprofit was incredible. I kept being asked by insurance underwriters, this sounds like a class action suit waiting to happen. And I said, no, you don't understand. There are people in the Northeast and on the West Coast that have been doing this forever. But Texas underwriters really didn't get it in terms of what the buyers were being sold. And trying to explain, no, it's not a subprime lending product was also quite a challenge at the time. There are also restrictions on primary residency and length of occupancy. And one of the things we started looking at in Texas were other communities' ground leases. And because it was kind of a model that grew out of the Northeast, there were these strange provisions that said you only had to live in your home 9 months out of the year. We were kind of scratching our heads. Well, it gets really cold in the North. And so there were a lot of people that moved south, snowbirds. And so you learn to tailor those restrictions. Another thing that we've seen recently is kind of an exception for reservists. They're being called to duty. And so that's one area where a lot of CLTs have had to rethink their primary residency restrictions and allowing some of the owners to actually rent their homes if they're being called to duty to serve. Reasonable use and compliance with laws. The nonprofit has an interest in making sure that house stays there and isn't subject to any number of issues that could happen. So you do require that homeowner to comply with the law. Inspection of a home by the Community Land Trust or CLT. You don't want to be too invasive, because it's not a rental property, you're not the landlord. You want to instill the sense of home ownership in the buyer. And so that's really a fine line that the Community Land Trust walks. We think of it more of kind of a windshield inspection. If you drive by, the lawn is mowed, the house is in good shape, that's generally enough to satisfy the organization. There is a ground lease fee and also a provision for a fee adjustment over time. And that ground lease fee is generally nominal. It's $10 to $25 a month. And it serves as more of a canary in the coal mine, meaning if the buyer's not paying that monthly ground lease fee, there's probably something else wrong. And so there's really high contact between the organization and the buyer to make sure that buyer's in good shape. And that also somewhat serves as a foreclosure prevention mechanism as well. You may have limits on construction and alterations. A prime example is out at Mueller. Everybody's restricted out there. You're not going to be able to add on to those homes, not because of what the land trust is doing necessarily, but because of the property owners association. However, land trusts have an interest in making sure their homes stay affordable, so you don't want the buyers to add gold-plated fixtures or granite or marble countertops, that kind of thing. So a lot of times you will see restrictions on what the buyers can do. It also tends to be tailored to the interest of the land trust or even the specific community. If you're truly a starter home type of organization and are there to kind of serve as a step up to market rate housing, you're not going to want households to add two more bedrooms, for instance. You're going to want to either find them another product that would be suitable or a way to get them into housing that's, you know, fits the needs of their families as they grow. Other land trusts have an interest in making sure people stay in the neighborhood or stay in their communities, and so sometimes they allow additions or room expansions. Purchase option price, the resale formula, is probably the most critical piece, and we'll walk through the math and kind of mechanics of how that works. Assignment and sublease are generally prohibited. We did talk about some situations maybe where the land trust would be okay with that, and I did refer to the foreclosure prevention pieces of Fannie Mae's community land trust product that are really amazing, and especially in today's world. So this is the math, and I know this is a little hard to read, and I'm going to get my notes as well so I can walk you through kind of the technicality of that resale formula. But basically, if you have a sales price of $120,000, we're looking at that first column, which is a community land trust model. You have, for instance, a $40,000 subsidized land cost. So in this example, we're truly taking the land cost out of the equation. What I can tell you is this may or may not be reflective of your actual resale model. You could have a subsidy that's less than your land cost or greater than your land cost. The subsidy doesn't necessarily have to be tied to that land value. In Austin, we've been pretty lucky because it generally is just the way the math works. But there are some communities, for instance, like Flagstaff, Arizona, where the land is fairly inexpensive, construction costs are incredibly high, given they kind of have a short construction frame time, and just transportation costs for construction materials are a lot higher in Flagstaff. So it may or may not correspond to the actual land versus improvement cost. So the sales price to that first buyer in the CLT model is $80,000. $120,000 sales price, you take out the land value of 40, giving you $80,000. The market value in 10 years, and I think I used a 6% increase rate over 10 years, ends up being about $215,000. So what happens is you have an increase of value of about $95,000. You take, for instance, and you can, there's a ton of research out there, and I have some resources listed at the end of the presentation on resale formulas. You can tie it to indexes, CPI, for instance. You can tie it to mortgage rate indexes. In this, I went with a straight 25% of appreciation, which is probably the easiest to explain. So in this case, 25% of that increase goes back to the buyer. So in this case, the buyer makes essentially $24,000 when they go to sell that home. That is a pretty significant return on investment for a low to moderate income person. When you look at some of the other wealth creation vehicles available to low to moderate income families, IDA programs, for example, individual development accounts, their general rate of return on those products is about 5 to 10%. When you're looking at shared equity home ownership, it's about a 28% return on investment. Market rate home ownership is generally 33 to 38%. So it's fairly comparable, and it builds significant wealth. So what happens on resale, and this is key, is that you have to make the buyer whole. You have to give him back his share of appreciation. He doesn't owe anything else. In a lot of traditional mortgage subsidy programs, the buyer repays that initial $40,000 in subsidy. And what's key about the land trust product is that subsidy stays with the house forever. So you're not recycling that investment, because basically if you did, you wouldn't have a chance in a rising housing market to make that house affordable again. So in this model, that subsidy stays with the house, that home stays affordable in perpetuity, essentially. So the price on resale is that $80,000 plus what you had to pay the buyer. And a lot of times land trust will add in a fee, a servicing fee or transaction fee as well, that gets added to the sales price for that next buyer. So in this example, and I'm not going to run through that traditional mortgage subsidy example, but just the bottom line basically is what we're looking at. On resale to the second buyer, that land trust home stays affordable. The next price to that second buyer is about $103,000, $104,000. If it went market, it would be at about $215,000. So you can see how the kind of resale formula works to keep that home permanently affordable.
Going the other way.
Yeah. This shows you kind of over time, given different programs, how well the land trust product performs. An initial investment, in this case of $50,000, will make that home affordable in perpetuity. Over time, all of the other mechanisms require additional investments. And so from a public subsidy standpoint, it makes so much sense. You're not having to add money. It's just a one-point-in-time initial investment. When to consider land trust products? When subsidy amounts are high, and especially when incomes aren't rising as fast as home prices, which I think everybody's seeing right now pretty much. When your goal is to preserve a stock of affordable housing. Also when funds are not available to resubsidize housing, which I think is a concern all around too. And also when there are limited future development opportunities. If you're built out, for instance, you're not going to have an opportunity to build more affordable housing. Just real quick, this is kind of a snapshot of our business model and how we explain to developers that we make it really easy for them. We provide a pipeline of qualified home buyers, giving builders an ability to have essentially pre-qualified pre-sales up front, which helps with their construction financing. We also have or are developing a social investment vehicle, and for lack of a better word, it's an affordable housing real estate investment trust that allows a social investor to donate some money to the organization and receive a small rate of return. And that's through built-in fees that we charge on resale, but we're still able to make the home affordable. So we're able to leverage public and private investment. Finally, working with local governments and lenders is key as well. And there's a list of resources. It will be, I think the presentations will be uploaded to the website, but there are some really good resources out there on shared equity products. So take a look if you have a chance. And I think that's it. Thank you.
So we have about 5 minutes left, so I'll open it up for questions. Dan?
Threshold of the housing market is above what tax credit housing
So the cost, you're saying the cost offsets that are given to the developers are not worth enough to...
The subsidy has to come from somewhere. Where it comes from is increasing the modest price of the market rate. So affordable housing and a success, inclusionary zoning and a successful housing market is a complete shell game, and it's a net gain of affordable housing, zero. I'm curious whether the degree to which the community land trust addresses both of those issues, the strangled production pipeline of tax-credit housing, and the inherent deceptiveness of affordable housing, of inclusionary zoning as a way of producing
Well, and I think we're starting to see some of that in Austin. One of the things that we found at the airport redevelopment, for instance, they were, as Liz mentioned, they're required to sell 25% total of their units as affordable housing. On the home ownership side, it means targeting households at 80% of median family income or below. So we're seeing affordable housing, home ownership opportunities out there priced between $120,000 and $160,000. The next market rate level of housing starts at about $300,000. There is a huge gap between $160,000 and $300,000. And when you start, you know, I'm told all the time, why aren't you serving teachers and firefighters? When you start looking at incomes of teachers and firefighters, they're over 80%. Most of them are at 100%. And so I think that is a real problem. I think we've focused on affordable housing, and it's a true need, and I don't want to diminish that need at all. But there's also a gap that's left kind of in the middle that has no opportunity. And so that's something at Mueller we're actually starting to take a look at. We're going to do another mixed-income housing symposium to try and come up with solutions to house hospital techs, which are hugely important out there with a new hospital district being formed. But it is a problem. And part of the problem, too, is that public funding is generally not available to serve those incomes. HUD's regulations are you serve 80% or below. Nonprofits' hands are generally tied too. You serve 80% or below. It's kind of an IRS thing. So what we're starting to take a look at and what you're seeing somewhat across the nation, you see a lot of nonprofits spinning off for-profits, and you're just really starting to see this to try and fill that gap. And so I think that's a very valid point. We're seeing it here in Austin as well. So I do think once you get there, though, the land trust model, if you can figure out how to kind of subsidize that initial buy down, and it's not even as much. Maybe it's, you know, these people don't need 40 to 80,000. They only need 10 to 25,000. But most government programs that provide mortgage assistance don't serve those income levels. No. Now, there is some state legislation. If you fall within Texas, as recently, or specifically Austin, state legislation focused on Austin has focused on 80% or below. But there would be nothing from having a private company, for instance, provide a land trust housing model, or even some nonprofits are starting to serve up to 120% of MFI. And mortgage credit certificates are another option. In Austin, we go up to 115%, which provides some benefits for that those kind of that gap that's missing or left behind.
Liz, did you want to respond at all to his?
Yeah, I mean, I just
can
think
you use the mic?
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I think that you were trying to say that inclusionary zoning is somehow making the people, the next run up, pay for the affordable units that are produced. Is that what your argument is? Because that, I mean, it wouldn't work for long if that was the case. They have to, I mean, the Montgomery County case, they're finding that some of these, the people are voluntarily participating in it because they're able to get more market units on their development than they would have otherwise. I mean, I agree with the point about there is a big problem of this gap, that we generally have programs that serve a certain point, and then in hot markets, we have this huge gap between the market and that. But I think the inclusionary zoning thing is just more complicated. But I had kind of a follow-up, because thinking of public costs associated with the land trust, I wondered if you could talk about the property tax issue, because that's kind of a big piece of keeping the land value fairly stable, and it has, you know, has a public consequence.
Right before fixing FHA, that's on my list, to fix the property tax scheme in Texas. It's a huge problem. I'm in meetings on a weekly basis with the general counsel of the Travis County Appraisal District on how to figure that one out, and I say it all the time, until we truly figure out a property tax system that makes some sense, affordable housing's an even greater challenge. And that's not only true for 80% or below, I think that's true up the income scale as well. So,
you know, I'm sorry, I have to run to another session, but Andy has agreed to be moderator.
One question for you, Emily. Is your research available?
Yes, it's actually on the CNU website.
Oh, good.
That data I showed. Yeah. So, I guess we are over our time limit, and I'm sorry we have to cut it off. Thank you all very much. And thank you, our panelists. Fantastic.
Thank you.
So, all of you are just awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Sure,
thanks. Yeah, thank you for organizing.
Really, really informative. My gosh, I learned so much.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. Hi. But I didn't get a chance to ask you about other things. Like, my one question I was going to ask everybody was going to be, what would you have CNU as an organization do?
Yeah.
Have a conference? You know, what? What could they do?
Somebody was showing me something that Jennifer Hurley was working on, which was integrating affordable housing policies into the smart code and ways to get organized by the transects, and which policies and which design approaches would be relevant.
Cool.
And yeah, I thought that was really neat. I didn't have time to look at it, so
yeah,
a copy of it, but
yeah.
I think that's
one
avenue we should definitely be pursuing.
Let's stay in touch.
Yeah, I'd like that. Yeah. This is my first Congress, actually, so yeah, I'm a newbie, but I go to the Florida ones. Yeah, I am. It's been a really great experience so far, so hopefully I'll be at several more in the future.
Yeah, well, thanks again.
Sure, thank you. I did.
Wow.
Yeah, do you have a card or yeah. Great. And if I'm slow in emailing you, feel free to email me or bug me, and I'll make sure to send it to you. Would you rather have a hard copy or PDF? Either way.